Okay, good morning. One of the things chiefly that differentiates Ramana's offering of this investigation, this reflection, this examination of what you are as really the final path, is that it really doesn't require anything, that you do anything to change anything about yourself. There has never been, I am sure, a less spiritual teaching than the teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And that's difficult to see because of the context and the trappings in which he's appeared, and also because of the context and the trappings in which we arrive at his offering. But it really is. It is the least spiritual teaching you can imagine. There's nothing specially sacred about the practice of self-inquiry. There's nothing apart. There's no apartness to it. There's no, first you must, you know, in some practices and in some teachings, the thing is that first you must rid yourself of negative tendencies and negative emotions, and you have to go through a long period of work to rid yourself of these things in order to make yourself able and worthy, I suppose, and capable of receiving the teaching. In some, the practice doesn't require you to exactly scrub yourself clean of all your stupidities and foolishnesses, but it does require you for the time of the practice to do so. So it requires you to sit and undergo a definite regimen of preparation and kind of rendering of sacredness to the event of your practice. Most of that just is because we like to do that stuff. But it's pawned off on us as being the idea that spirituality is separate from real life. Spirituality is separate from the ordinary day-to-day business of making a living, fighting the traffic, brushing your teeth, all that stuff that goes into living your life moment by moment. That spirituality is something that is apart from all that, is perhaps a goal to attain, to escape from all that, but certainly is apart from all that. Is different, separate. That's not the case with the teaching of Ramana Maharshi. The teaching of Ramana Maharshi is simply the offer of the possibility for you at any time, all the time, constantly, consistently, repeatedly, to look at yourself, to allow this ever-present, self-evident reality of what you are to fill your conscious mind, your conscious, awake mind. Actually, it's even less than that, since it already does fill your conscious mind. Since every thought, every desire, every aversion, every good thing about you, every bad thing about you is saturated, is soaked in this certainty that you are, which is all there is to self-realization, is this certainty that you are, which is never absent, never missing. So Ramana's offering is a lot less than I can possibly say about it. It is just to look consciously, whenever you can, to see this certainty of being that is ever-present, unmoving, unchanging. And the promise is that over time, the reality that all of what you are and all of what you do and all of what you think is already saturated with that realization will be no longer hidden. There'll be no longer a basis for you to pretend that anything else is the case. No longer a reason for you to pretend that you are subject to the vicissitudes of life and what you get and what you don't get and what you want and what you don't want. It's not a matter of eliminating wanting and not wanting. If we eliminate wanting and not wanting, well, we just die. That's when wanting and not wanting is gone, when you die. But it is eliminating the treacherous energy of clinging and resistance. That's the perversion of the natural activity of human life, which is to want this and not want that. And to the simple, innocent, wanting this and not wanting that, no residue applies. No ugliness adheres. No suffering is caused. So, the retreat's over. It's finished. It's a miracle to me that it occurs at all. I am, every time this happens, it dumbfounds me. It stuns me that such a thing could come into being. In truth, there's no need for it. In truth, there is no need for it. You are here. Whether you are in formal retreat or driving a car, fighting traffic, you are here. You are never absent. Be playful with yourself. You know, this really isn't serious business. This business of self-investigation. This really isn't serious, hard work that makes you work nights and weekends and so forth. It's you. And you're always available. I remember, I'm going to tell you a little story just because I want to. During the time when I was trying, and I was very serious about trying to understand Ramana and trying to do what Ramana has asked of us, and it's okay to be serious about it. I mean, really, you don't have to be, but it's okay to be. I certainly was. I was serious as a heart attack, but I was desperate. You may not be so desperate as I was. And I read Ramana, I read and read and read, and most of what he said seemed contradictory to me. It didn't make any sense. But still, I tried. I really tried to understand what he was offering. And the one thing that ran through it was to just do it. You know, I mean, just do it. Whether you understand it or don't, just do it. And I, in that time, had a really advanced spiritual understanding, and the teachings of Ramana Maharshi seemed to be simplistic and not very smart. like his talk of the I thought. I mean, he talked about the I thought as if it was a real thing. And of course, in my advanced spiritual understanding, I knew that that could not be true, that there could not be such a thing as I. But still, I was so desperate that I, you see that? I was so desperate that I was willing to entertain the possibility that I could see the I thought appear. And I cultivated this, what I thought to be a habit of inwardness, inward turning mind. And anyone who has ever tried to look within can testify to the absurdity of finding anything within or finding some direction that answers to the name of inward. Nevertheless, since I was told to look inward, I was determined to look inward, no matter how spiritually bankrupt such an idea was obviously to me. So I would spend most of my time trying to make my mind inward turned, looking inward. Where's inward? What's the direction of inward? Well, it's kind of in here, right? In here, somewhere. Somewhere inside my head, somewhere inside my body. What else could it be? And I tried to make it so that all the time that I was walking and talking and doing my life, and this was when I was in prison, which gave me the luxury of spending time attending such foolishness. But everything I did, I tried to do and keep my mind turned inward, whatever that meant. I figured that if I continued to try to do so, that I would find inward. I would find what inward was. And that perhaps I would be granted the boon of actually seeing this I thought. And I remember one day I was in the shower in prison, and I was rinsing my left armpit while keeping my mind turned inward, trying to see the one who was feeling the water on my body and the soap and so forth, trying to see that one, the subject of all of this, the seer of all of this, steadfastly turned inward, when suddenly I saw it. I saw this thought, this spark of identity, and I don't mean that like misidentity, just this spark of identity, the feeling of identity appearing like the very beginning of a rocket in a fireworks show in a dark, dark sky. This bright spark that looked and felt and tasted exactly like identity. And I saw it, and I saw it very clearly. I saw it very clearly as it, like a fireworks, only in more dimensions, exploded and manifested into remembrance and intention and expectation and story and what I was and what I want to be and what I'm going to do when I'm done with this shower and how I'm going to act and where I need to go and what I'm going to do tomorrow and what I'm going to be and how I'm going to keep inward turned. And I saw this whole array, this incredible, magnificent explosion of beauty, that of wanting and not getting, of needing and not having, of desiring and not receiving, of contentment and anxiety, of expectation and disappointment, of all the aspects that go into the story of me. And I saw it all form and ramify and branch off, and all of them, all of these aspects just flying apart and falling back into the dark sky and disappearing and reforming and a new speck, a bright, insignificant, infinitesimal speck appearing in the dark sky. And I knew that that's exactly what Ramana refers to as the I thought. I knew that. And it didn't do me a bit of good. It didn't change anything about my continued spiritual inanity. It didn't suddenly transform me and turn me into the Buddha. It didn't suddenly wipe out all of my misunderstanding and confusion and false ideas and false hopes and any of that. It didn't do any of that. It was a great gift. It was a thing of beauty. And it didn't give me a thing. But it certainly was part of the ongoing activity that is begun in the moment that you begin the investigation into your nature, which you cannot do wrong. I mean, if I can do it, anybody can do it, which you cannot do wrong. It certainly contributed to and was a part of that ongoing process over which you have nothing to say, which you will not even be able to notice happening, which will seem to have no fruit for a long time, the ongoing process of the gradual erosion and dissolution of the idea that you are the story that's being told about you. No matter how big that story is, no matter how magnificent the story is, and it is, I tell you, much more magnificent and huge than you can imagine. It is the entire unwinding of the universe is a story about you. But what will happen as the result of persistent and continuous effort to keep your mind inward turned without searing at the stupidity of that idea, to keep your attention steadfastly looking for this feeling that is never absent, that's here always, no matter how stupid that idea seems to you, since it is here always. This belief that now forms a cloud of occlusion and ignorance that seems to prevent you from seeing reality will disappear over time. And with it, all of your whatever inclination you may have to murder your neighbor or to take from others in order that you can have what you need. It will eliminate within you all aggression. Won't eliminate anger. Anger is not a problem. will eliminate from within you all the murderous intent that is endlessly being formed in this struggle to be something. The murderous intent that takes shape in your desire to fix yourself, to do away with your murderous intent, to do away with your neurotic impulses. So the point of this, if there is a point, is that there is no special time for the investigation. There's no special circumstance for the investigation. There's no special right way of doing the investigation. The intention is everything. There's nothing to it but the intention. And the intention, if you, part of your investigation and part of your reflection should be upon the self-evident fact that this has always been your intention, that there's nothing you've ever wanted but to know what you are. So the intention is already here. It is nothing. It is less than a speck of dust standing between you and being finished with it forever. Anybody? Richard?
I wanted to ask a question that I've never heard you talk about, and it's something that maybe you have, but I haven't been around that long. But I wanted to ask about the Sangha, because for some teachers, the community is really important feature, and they've got this community gathering, and they really emphasize, you know. And for some other teachers, I think they talk like, well, it's individual, and this is not a social club, and you know, look inward, and or I don't even know what they say, but I know they say. You know, for me, I think if I met any one of these people on the street, I would drop directly into deep being, and I'd start laughing. And, you know, I could be dependent on that, too. I don't know. I mean, I don't think I will be, but, you know, hopefully I could do that with everyone some fine day.
What I think about Sangha is that it's not my business. I would encourage you and everybody else, if it's possible to do so, to love one another as best you can, and to support one another as best you can. But the actual reality of material circumstances that we come here from places as widely separated as Ojai, California, Chicago, Illinois, God knows where in Australia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, so that the possibility of forming a cohesive and coherent Sangha seems to me to be unlikely, unless there's somebody really works at it. And if somebody really works at it, then, well, it's work and not my business. It is, the Sangha is all of humanity. And that's the truth. The idea that there is a separate group of people specially called together to support one another is, in my view, part of the whole specialness of spirituality, which is false. There is no separation between spirit and world. You know, I had somebody write me a note, which she expects me to answer, about why I don't talk about nature. I think this is going to come around to being on point to what you're asking, but we'll see. why I don't talk about nature. You know, she said all the spiritual people talk about nature, about being in nature and the beauty of it and all that. And, well, there's a couple things about that. One is I am city born and bred. And I have had precious little opportunity to spend time in that which she is calling nature. To me, the city is nature. I mean, after all, are we not nature? Are human beings not a natural occurrence? And aren't human beings the creator of cities and commerce and so forth? Are we somehow outside of nature, in opposition to nature? But in any event, I don't have a lot of experience out in the, I don't have a lot of pleasant experience out among the trees and the breeze and the birds and the bees and the insects and reptiles and so forth. There's nothing whatsoever that you are not. There's no one that you are not. So that to support one another is a noble thing. But really, you're on your own. Really you are. And really, the investigation into your nature is not a social activity. It really is not. It doesn't mean that social activity is bad. And it doesn't mean that like-minded people cannot, you know, I mean, I don't hang out with people that I don't like. And I, you know, and so that like-minded people tend to get together socially. But the investigation in this reflection on your, on the reality of what you are, you're absolutely on your own. Really. And there's little that can be done to, other than to tell the truth to one another. Really. Tell the truth to one another. But to gather together in a supportive atmosphere and environment, that's wonderful. It's really great. I don't think it'll happen when we're as widely separated geographically as we are. But I'd be happy to see it happen. There is the internet.
It's marvelous. And, just tune in to you.
Huh?
We'll tune in and you'll be there.
And I am, actually I'm looking into making better use of the internet for satsang. We're looking at some possibilities that are present for having satsang on the internet, where we gather together with video and audio and like that.
You can ask questions. And
yeah. I don't know if that's going to happen, but there's a possibility of that.
It's happening in some places, and, you know, every year is just such a revolution with
It can be very expensive, you know, to have the kind of technology that's required in order to have real-time streaming video and audio where there's interaction between everybody can be quite expensive.
I'll bet you anything there's services that do that. You just subscribe to them. And
yeah. Well, in any event,
that's not
that notwithstanding.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that there is no other thing.
Well, thank you.
If you can support one another, do so. Really. But don't forget this. This is, you're on your own. The idea that anybody whatsoever can be the agent to give you or prevent you from seeing the reality of what you are, whether that is a guru or a sangha, is false. Really. If we are together all the time and we have nothing to concern ourselves with other than self-investigation, then what is that? Live your life. be in the Sangha of humanity. Live your life. See what you are when you are in the presence of other people whom you despise. Find out who it is that despises these people. Don't do away with the despising. Just find out who it is that despises them. When you're in the presence of other people that you admire and that you wish to emulate, find out who it is that admires and wishes to emulate these people. When you're in the presence of other people about whom you feel indifference or any other reaction to the relationships that you have in your life, whether they are long-lasting or just a momentary passing in the checkout stand, look and see who it is that has this sense of what the nature of the relationship is between you and this person. This is to be part of the Sangha of humanity. This is to use everything to... There is nothing you can do for humanity, nothing other than to find out what you are. That's it. That's the whole of what you can do, is to see what you are and to... You know, the idea of Sangha, to me, it turns out I must have more to say about this than I thought I did. The idea of Sangha, to me, presupposes the idea that there's some difficulty and some need for continuous support in seeing reality, in discovering that you're free. And there is no difficulty in that. There is no reason to withdraw yourself from the ordinary commerce of human activity, to gather in groups that see things the same way. Really, there is none. If you see that the Sangha is all of humanity, then you see that there's only one thing you can do to help humanity, and that is to find out what you are and to support whatever truly makes it more likely for everybody in humanity to know the truth of what they are. The rest of it is all social fun. And nothing wrong with it, but social fun. You don't need Sangha. You are freedom without condition, always and forever. The Sangha needs you. Okay?
Thank you.
But, you know, don't hesitate to talk to each other. Email each other. Or talk to each other on the phone. I mean, for God's sake, you can be friends. Yes, Patrice. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. So, it's interesting, endings, you know, ending of retreats. And one of the things that I haven't heard you talk about, and you've been beating up all the books and taking them to task, is the one thing that I have to say, thank God I'm not looking for any longer. And that is the blessing of the teacher that says, you got it. And now go teach, go live your life in the ecstasy, you know. And I want to tell you that so many books, and I have Papaji films where he has blessed them. I've read stories of people that have finally, after being with the master for so long, they have been bestowed with, you've got it, now go, blah, blah, blah.
I tell you from the very beginning, you've got it. There's never been a moment when you haven't had it. The idea, the whole idea that there's something, you know, that the whole misunderstanding is based on the idea that there's something new for you to get that isn't already here, that you don't already know. It's not already absolutely, totally manifest in you. That's the whole problem. That's based on this idea that you're somebody who needs something you don't have. And it's a lie. So I tell you all, you have the blessing of the universe. You are awake forever. But as to teaching, I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
I don't want to be wished with that either.
You know, and this is interesting, Patrice, because I remember that in the very beginning of this adventure that Gangaji sent me on, it seemed obvious to me that if you were awake, if you were realized, that you would be a teacher, right? I mean, that's how you tell if somebody's awake. If they're awake, they're a teacher. And if they're not awake, they're not a teacher. And, boy, that is so stupid. I am honored and blessed beyond all comprehension to have found myself in this role. But it, in no way, the teacher who in any way promotes or encourages or does not actively try to destroy the idea that the teacher is superior to the students is a false teacher. It is someone who does not see the reality of their role and their relationship to the teacher. It is someone who has somehow falsely conflated the teaching with themselves, as if there were something in me that bestowed upon you the grace of awakening and realization. It is a great mystery to me. You know, I look at the circumstances that have conspired to put me in this very peculiar role, and they seem quite ordinary, really, and very, quite commonplace. You know, I came out of prison after 18 and a half years in prison. I was Gangaji's pet, and it's really true, and had a great deal of attention within the Gangaji Sangha, and some expectation and certainty in the Sangha that I would become a teacher, and, you know, kind of carrying on the teaching of Gangaji. And I never saw it that way. And for a very long time, I resisted it. I really did not want it to happen. I mean, I'm not just saying that. Anybody who knows me from that time will, I'm sure, attest to the fact that I really did not want this, did not want it. The main reason I didn't want it is because I knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I was unsuited for this role, that I was not this Buddha mind that could bestow upon the people who came to me realization and enlightenment. It was really obvious to me. And I, in my ignorance at the time, thought that that's what a teacher should be. I didn't want it. But circumstances conspired against my desire. People would ask me to come and speak, and after a while I started saying yes, okay, and I didn't have a job, and I seemed to have no way to make a living. I mean, I came out of prison, 18 and a half years in prison. already an old man who's going to hire, my only skill is a machinist, and I don't know if anybody's going to hire a 60-year-old ex-convict machinist. It seemed that as time went on, it seemed that there was nothing whatsoever I could do to make a living except be a teacher. Still didn't want to. It's only in the last 2 years that I really have attained some clarity as to my role and what it is, what I have to offer and what I have to give and so forth. It's only really in the last 2 years or so that the resistance to this role has fallen away from me, and I have begun to see the gift that it is and the opportunity it affords me to be your servant, really, that I really can be helpful to you, that I really can be of help, not by being a guru, but by virtue of the fact that I did it. I followed Ramana's advice. I found out for myself. And I really can be of use to you. But it's only in the last couple of years that I've seen that. But the idea that awakening means, you know, Papaji, for God's sake, I almost feel like telling you, turn the sound off. Papaji, who I love. I could tell you stories about Papaji and when I was in prison but I won't. Spiritual stories, and I won't. But Papaji, I don't know what he was thinking with this business of sending everybody out to be teachers. I don't know what he was thinking, unless he was just trying to, well, cause trouble. You know, he was, after all, an Indian nationalist and a bomber. We have that in common, Papaji and I. Yeah. And he was very much full of mischief and didn't take seriously all of this spiritual stuff. He enjoyed it immensely. But he liked cricket better. I mean, what does that say? Anybody know anything about cricket? I say about this business of teaching, I say to all of you that you are absolutely, permanently, eternally awake. There has never been a moment, a second, a breath when you have not been nothing other than absolutely awake, aware, eternal consciousness. You cannot not be that. There's nothing you can do to make yourself ignorant. Nothing. Try as you might. You cannot do that. You are the self realized, just as you are, exactly as you are. You are the self realized. You are enlightenment itself. Nothing can give that to you. Nothing can take that away from you. And if it comes upon you to be your lot, to teach others, and you know, Papaji also, that's another bone I have to pick with Papaji. This whole business of no teacher, no teaching, no student. Well, that sounds really, really spiritual. Right? You know, it is what I speak of when I speak of the literature and the utterance of outcomes. But it does us no good. Those of us who find ourselves trapped in the idea that we are in bondage and suffering and unfree, it does us no good to come to us and say, no teacher, no teaching, no student. We want to hear what we can do to help ourselves. We want to hear what we can do to help ourselves. So if it should fall upon you, any of you, anybody, to find themselves in the role of a teacher of this offering of Ramana, well, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, and I wish you all the luck in the world should it come to pass. Tell the truth. Do the best you can to tell the truth. That's all you can do to help people, is to tell the truth. Do not hold out false spiritual ideas. Do not hold out false goals and aspirations. Tell the truth. All is awake. All is awareness. It is only this false belief that somehow mystery of mysteries creates this idea of misery and suffering. And it's only the truth that will set you free. And it's unspiritual to speak of being set free, but I am not a very spiritual teacher. The truth will set you free. The truth will eliminate this false idea. And nothing else will. Nothing. No work on yourself. No fixing yourself. No becoming clear or letting go of anything or any of that. None of that. All of it's fine. All of it is okay. It all has its place. But it cannot in any way destroy this false belief that you are the one who is clear or unclear, ignorant or enlightened. Nothing can do that but the truth. And the truth is here. So if it falls upon you to bring this teaching to anybody, tell them the truth. Don't lie to them as best you can. And good luck to you.
Okay, I have another thing about this.
Okay.
So, you've had a few conversations over this few days about when you get to a certain point, you stop doing certain things and you're more, you know, clear path. And
I hope I didn't say that.
Yes. The thing that happens, though, I don't see an absolute guaranteed relief of stupidity or humanness in being granted this so-called gift to teach. And like you mentioned about Papaji bestowing teaching credentials on almost every single person that crossed his path. I met one of his teachers that had been teaching, he still teaches, and at the end of his satsang, there was a very voluptuous blonde in the front rows that he immediately put his eyes upon and said, "You've got it. You've got it. And please come forward."
I wish I
"Please come forward." And so she went forward, and he was down a little bit, and she leaned, and he said, "Hug me." And she leaned into him and gave him a very big hug. At that point, I left the meeting. Now, recently, I had a person that I was going to that was a teacher, and all of a sudden there were situations that occurred in the life, and people around him decided that he shouldn't be teaching any longer, and they went to Gangaji and almost insisted that she revoke his teaching privileges. That she was totally wrong in the moment that she had blessed him with the credentials to teach.
And?
She wouldn't take him back.
And?
So the issue isn't about, I don't get that it's a permanent, I mean, I just think that it's kind of a silliness like this.
I think the mistake you're making here, Patrice, uh-huh, is thinking that the fact that Gangaji has bestowed anything on anybody says anything about anybody, and thinking that anything that anybody else does has anything to do with you. You are here.
Yes.
What is it to you, really? You are here.
Right.
I tell you this, I tell you from my heart, that if you are willing to spend every moment that you possibly can spend, not determining who's a good teacher and who's a bad teacher, but every moment you possibly can spend with your attention fully engaged with the feeling of being you, I promise you that the belief that you are anything other than that will depart. I don't promise you that you will become a rocket scientist, but I promise you that the belief that you are anything other than that will depart. And that this life, this personality, this creature, will be happy. That's what I promise you. I don't promise you will ever teach anybody anything, and I will never, ever, you will never hear me bestow any credentials on anyone for anything, except this credential. You are awake awareness itself. You are that now. You are that in the presence of false teachers. You are that in the presence of true teachers. You are awake consciousness itself. You have never been other than that, and there's never been a moment that you haven't known that. You're here. And that's all that I'm here to talk about. You. Just you. You hear me?
I do. Thank you.
Okay. You know, there is more stupid, ugly mischief taking place within the realm of Advaita spirituality than in the White House. But what does that have to do with you? Really? You are untouched by it all. You look and see if I'm not telling the truth. You are here. You are awake. You've never not been awake. Okay?
Yes.
Okay. You do what I ask and you let me know. Okay? Okay.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Mary, don't get me started on Advaitin.
When you say, you told the story of what happened to you in the shower and the experience, if I understand you correctly, of the I thought, and this kind of explodes into this infinite kind of experience. And then you said, if I'm understanding you, can reach a point where you're done with it. What did you mean by being done with it? Because, like, on the one hand, I want to interpret that as, well, you know, you're done with all your problems. You're not going to have your problems anymore. But I suspect you obviously don't mean that. But what do you mean when you say?
No, well, it depends on what you mean by problems. I mean, my life has the same problems as any other life, right? I have to pay my rent. I have difficulty doing so. I have health issues that come from time to time, and I don't always understand clearly what I should be doing, and I do the wrong thing and wish I'd done the right thing, and just like anybody else. Those problems are just part of the story about me that will continue for as long as the story continues. The problems that lead me to suffering and the desire to eliminate all those problems are gone. There is no existential problem.
So in the sense that you're not working on yourself anymore, or do you mean that in this being done with it all is like being done with
trying to live your life in the story.
Trying to. I do live my life in the story. I don't try to. I've always lived my life in the story. Where else would I live it?
I guess I'm still not distinguishing between the kind of problems that you're saying are inevitable and...
It's the suffering. It's the clinging and resistance, Larry.
So any type.
It's the idea that something's at stake here.
So any type of problem issue that you're dealing with that leads to suffering residue, you're saying.
See, that's what I'm telling you. Is the problems of life, the vicissitudes of life, do not lead to suffering and residue. What leads to suffering and residue is the belief that something's at stake here, that I. Indeed, I'm at stake here. And that belief can be discarded.
So to investigate the I thought, then, is to penetrate in that thought, that in that life of the I thought, that there is something at stake with respect to my reality.
No, that's just fixing the story to do it, to see it that way. If you investigate this, and here's the thing. And somebody asked me yesterday about Ramana's talking about I, and what in the world that meant, and I said, I have no idea. Well, I do have some idea, but I hesitate to speak of these things. Although Ramana doesn't hesitate to speak of these things, because there is nothing really special, right? It's not like there is this spiritual realm which is unapproachable by ordinary thought or ordinary language. It certainly is not describable or evocable by ordinary thought and language, but we can talk about it. And Ramana was always willing to talk about it, and he invented a vocabulary for talking about it, which includes the distinction between the I thought and the I. Okay. Self-inquiry, self-investigation, can take two forms, right? One is the investigation into the nature of the I thought, by which we mean ego, by which we mean this sense of me as an individual, suffering, needy entity, for which everything is at stake in everything I do. Every thought I think, every action I take puts me on the line. There is this feeling that is present that when thinking is happening, that I am the thinker. When doing is happening, that I am the doer. When consequences are being suffered, that I am the receiver, the recipient of these consequences. There is this feeling that's present. It's very strong, sometimes strong, sometimes not so strong. When the vicissitudes of life are very strongly present, then the feeling of me, which is the I thought, is very strongly present. It is absolutely possible to investigate this feeling of me. Me, needy, short-sighted, self-involved, me. And that's what Ramana speaks of when he speaks of grabbing ego by the throat. I mean, how spiritual is that, for God's sake? Grabbing ego by the throat and holding on to it and not letting it go and looking at it. It is that me that is the I thought that Ramana speaks of investigating directly to see what it is. When the thinker is present, find out what that is. I mean, I know it's me. What is that? When I am seeing something beautiful, who is it that sees that? This is who am I. This is one part of the investigation. It is one component, one aspect, one way of performing the investigation. What is this? What am I, really? Who is the thinker? God, I'm so tired of this thinking and thinking and thinking. Well, that in that case, and that's a common experience, the thinker is very vividly present. So look and see. On the other hand, there is the reality of you, which is never absent. It doesn't fluctuate. It doesn't become more intense with circumstance and less intense as circumstance eases. It doesn't become affected by any consequences that arise within the circumstantial phenomenal world. It doesn't move. It doesn't change. It is ever the same, and you are ever aware of it.
And that's the I-I.
And that is what Ramana refers to as the I-I. The investigation into either aspect of this results in often together. For me, it was together. Results finally in the eradication of the belief that I am this I, this ego, this me. It eliminates that belief. Now, there's nothing whatsoever you can do to eliminate that belief apart from discovering the truth of what you are. There's no argument that can dissuade you from that belief, because the argument that dissuades you is dissuading someone who you believe yourself to be and changing the story of you, what you think you are. In the final analysis, the investigation into the I thought, into the feeling of me that gradually reveals it to be just a sensation. Really, it's just a sensation like any other sensational experience, coupled with the consistent, repeated willingness to consciously move into conscious awareness, this certainty of existence that's always here. You see, this is what you are. What comes and goes is not. What you are is what's always here, what's permanently present, what you always see, what you always know, what you are always aware of. The willingness to consciously move into conscious attention, this background, like the background radiance of the universe, that is in the end what kills the false belief. And when the false belief is gone, it doesn't mean that the I thought is gone. It doesn't mean that ego is gone. You have never been ego-ridden, you see. It's never been the case that you have been caught by ego. Doesn't mean that the story is gone. It just means that you are aware of what you have always been and finished with the idea that you are something other.
So then when you say to be done with it, I don't want to beat this horse to death, but when you say to be done with it, you're saying that when it's clear that the false belief is a false belief, and I'm not playing, obsessing with, which I have done probably infinitely, doubts about, you know, what part of that is me, or when I'm trying to get rid of parts of me that I don't like,
yeah,
then I'm playing with the belief. Then I'm probably
then you
caught.
Are within the belief.
Yeah,
then.
I'm in. It's got me.
Right.
And I have. And then the doubts start about 2-3 years ago when I was saying, right, this is all bullshit, and there is no I.
Right. Right. Which is absurd, because it's here. You're here. You're here. You're never not here. So the thing to see is that, number one, the falling back into this belief and the doubt and the fixing yourself and so forth in no way prevents you from seeing reality. There's not like you've backslidden in the Christian sense, right? And that's how we generally take it. But it's just what we have forever had this belief. And the idea that it's going to vanish overnight as a result of some guru hitting you on the forehead or some flash of thunderbolt from the sky is magical thinking. It's more craziness in the mind. The belief persists for quite a long time. So to discover that you're back in the belief is not, it says nothing whatsoever about your ability to see what you are, because even when you are trapped most deeply in this belief that you need fixing or that you're not what you think you are or whatever, even then, you still have the total awareness of the reality of what you are. Also, there's not a moment in time. This is the whole, this myth of awakening results from the idea that there is this moment in time. One moment you are captured by the belief, and the next moment the belief is gone forever. You don't even notice it going until you do. You don't even notice it. It's not like everything changes and all of a sudden you have oceanic consciousness and empty mind and all of that. You don't even notice it going. It's like the frog in the water. You turn put a frog in cold water and turn the heat on, and it'll stay there until it boils because it doesn't even notice what's happening. And it's the same way with the eradication of this belief. You don't even notice it going. It's not like, oh, is it still here? Is it still here? Right? But there comes a time when you realize that, wow, life is sweet. Life is easy, even when it's hard. I see what I am. I am free. Nothing that occurs within the circumstantial phenomenal world touches me. And you know that. It's not something that needs constant reminder. You know that. And the belief is gone. It's like some growth has fallen off or disappeared over when you weren't noticing it. But you won't regret. It's vanishing. And you won't regret the fact that it doesn't happen as a dramatic occurrence either. You won't say, oh my God, I wish it was like it. I thought it was when I read all those spiritual books. You say, wow, life is sweet. Life is easy. Life is really okay. And I am this. Okay, we're just about out of time, I think. God, it breaks my heart. So you can be heartbroken. It can be anything. The story of you is immense. The story that's being told about you is immense. It has its components, the secret deep world of quarks and atomic forces, the play of all of that going on, the incomprehensibility of things popping into and out of existence within this body, within this universe. It has as its components the biological, biochemical warfare and struggle that's ever playing out as your body. Your body is this story of itself. It's a huge story with nations and areas and enemies and aspirations and failures and disappointments and victories and all going on all the time, all part of this story about you and the neurochemistry of the brain flashing and moving and hormones, the acetylcholine and serotonin and all that stuff moving from cell to cell and lighting things up, and from which you make this mind, this idea of you and what you see and what you don't see and what things are, what they look like. Somehow, out of this inert unconscious matter, if there is such a thing as matter, of the brain, which itself has the all that quirkiness going on in its deepest depths. Somehow, out of that comes this idea of sound and vision and breath and light and dark and hot and cold and you and me, love and hate and anger and vindictiveness and compassion. And this story about you is all of these bodies and all of these humans and all of this quirkiness and all of the insects and reptiles and the nature and the concrete buildings of the city all having their own intricate inner life, working things out, expanding and contracting, rubbing against each other. All of this, part of this immense story of you and the solar system and the sun and the thermonuclear reaction that is the sun and the light and photons and the galaxies and the swirl of the cosmos and the stretch over the incomprehensible distance of time. The Big Bang, all of it, the inflationary period, the whole thing, the whole of it, the whole of time, the whole of matter, the whole of it, the totality of it, all telling a story about you. All of it telling a story about you. But you are here. Story falls short. For all of its immensity, for all of its complexity, for all of its incomprehensibility, for all of its beauty and magnificence, the story falls short. And if you believe yourself to be this human, this body, this being, this entity, subject to the vicissitudes of time and physicality, you will suffer. And if you believe yourself to be the universe, the cosmos, eternity itself, all of time and space and past and future, if you believe yourself to be that, you will suffer. And if you believe yourself to be open, empty, eternal consciousness, awareness, the light of awareness in which all things live and move and have their being, if you believe yourself to be that, you will suffer. You are here. You are absolutely, self-evidently, incomprehensibly, unspeakably here. Simple beyond all stories, all efforts, all ideas about you. Simple and perfect. You are here. So enjoy the stories. That's what they're here for. The way in which you are trying to show yourself to yourself, reveal yourself to yourself. Enjoy the stories. But know the truth. The truth is here. The truth is you. You are that about which all of this is being told. And you are here. You cannot be confused about that. You can try to be, but you cannot be. Whenever you can, in every moment that it's possible, look and see what it feels like to be. It's that simple. Look and see that you actually are certain of your existence. It's that certainty that you. It's that simple. No one can give you yourself. No one can take yourself away from you. You are hugely lucky to have been born in a time and place when this offering, this radical, simple, perfect teaching of Ramana Maharshi is available in the world. Really lucky beyond comprehension. Just do what he says as best you can. I'm so grateful to you for this time at Satsang. I truly am your servant. May all being know itself. Om Shanti. Thank you for this retreat.